From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, a special broadcast to coincide with the release of The Covenant with Black America 10 years later. In 2006, I was honored to help compile and edit the groundbreaking New York Times number one bestseller, The Covenant with Black America. And now, a decade after that text, laid out a national plan of action to address the 10 most crucial issues facing the black community, African Americans have lost ground in every leading economic category and continue to face steep challenges politically and socially, with fresh data provided by the Indiana University School of Public and Environmental Affairs. The Covenant with Black America, 10 years later, explores why our fellow black citizens have yet to fully claim our democracy. Today, we're joined by prominent voices from around the nation to explore why black America still faces crippling inequality. We begin with a look at the disparities in health care faced by African Americans. Pleased to be joined by environmental advocate and author of Thimerosal, Let the Science Speak, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and Princeton professor and author of Pain, A Political History, Keith Wailu. Good to have you both on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be here.
Let me jump right in. I can't think of a better way, Professor, than talking about the state of black America specifically, but more broadly, how these diseases and illnesses tend to impact people of color and poor people at rates that other people are not subjected to. Talk about your work and what you've learned about why certain communities seem disproportionately impacted.
The numbers are really frightening and of major concern. Asthma rates, 1.5 times more prevalent in the black community than white communities. Breast cancer, African-American women have lower prevalence, higher mortality, which suggests that there's something about reaching the care that exists that explain these disparities. Mm-hmm. Diabetes rates, the sixth leading killer of Americans. 6% of American whites have diabetes, 10% of American blacks. And as we learned by looking at the diabetes clip, the impact of diabetes is outsized in the black community. That is to say, you might have comparable or slightly higher rates of diabetes, but the impact, the renal failure, the cardiovascular disease, the longer stage sequelae of diabetes have a devastating impact, partly because of things like, when you go back to asthma, dust mites, dilapidated housing, poor housing conditions, and combined with the problem of hospital closures. So you have asthma as a problem where you have higher rates in black communities, but you also have three times the rate of hospitalization and three times the rate of deaths due to asthma. So you have the symptoms, you have the problem, and then you have the impact, which is even worse. Each of these has a very different origin.
Yeah. When we wrote the original book, The Covenant with Black America, 10 years ago, the state of health in black America was not good, to be clear. Mm-hmm. 10 years later, with the publication of this new book, The Covenant, 10 years later, the hope is that Obamacare is going to turn the corner on some of these maladies that black America and poor Americans experience. And yet, so much of that hasn't kicked in yet, and
That's
it's
right.
done nothing about the disparities. So how do we address the disparities, even if all the good provisions eventually kick in?
Well, it takes time, right? So what Obamacare has done is it's reduced the level of uninsurance for African Americans from 25% to 17%. Mm-hmm. What it's done is that it's moved the white uninsurance rate from 15% to 10%. So the gap has been reduced. Mm-hmm. We have a lowering of the gap in life expectancy from birth mm-hmm. over the long haul for the last 30 years. But lowering the gap of life expectancy is not the same as lowering a gap of health experiences. You can live just as long as somebody else, but be sicker during your time. Mm-hmm. And that is because of the nature of, I mean, to be frank, health inequalities are rooted in social inequalities. And the social inequalities that are of most concern are urban inequalities that are compounded by poverty, by low resources.
Yeah. Robert Kennedy Jr., always honored to have you on this program. Your most recent text that you're the editor of is called Thimerosal, Let the Science Speak. I'm fascinated by that subtitle. We'll get to Thimerosal in a second. But why is the science not speaking? And if it is speaking, why are we not hearing what it's saying on all of these issues?
I mean, aerosol is a mercury-based preservative that was in many American vaccines until 2003. Mm-hmm. It was removed from many of the pediatric vaccines, but it was put in the flu vaccine, mm-hmm. which is now given to 53 million Americans, thimerosal doses every year, including pregnant women. It's given disproportionately in poor communities because there's 180 million doses of flu vaccine, but the cheapest ones are the ones that are preserved with thimerosal, so they go to the urban clinics. African Americans are much more susceptible to vaccine injury. And people aren't looking at the science. There is abundant science out there that connects mercury exposure and vaccines to not only autism, but to ASD, to SIDS, to ADD, ADHD, speech delay, language delay, tics, which is like Tourette's syndrome, sure. OCD, asthma, food allergies, and diabetes. All of these illnesses became epidemic among American children in 1989. Mm-hmm. That's what EPA calls the gateway year. And that's the year that mercury exposures to American children were increased from 70 milligrams to 570 milligrams. So we've got this generation of children who we are injecting a neurotoxin that is 1,000 times more neurotoxic than lead into pregnant women, into children. We know that it causes these diseases. The science is as clear as it can be on that issue.
Let me ask you this. It's a silly question, but I think worth asking. When you think of vaccines, we think of medicine that heals us, medicine that cures us. How can it be that the vaccines that disproportionately poor people and black people are getting are harming them?
Well, I'm very pro-vaccine. I had all six of my kids vaccinated. I believe vaccines have saved millions of lives and people ought to be getting vaccinated. Mm-hmm. The message that particularly African Americans should hear is that when you're given a vaccine, make sure there's no mercury in it. Mm-hmm. Ask your doctor. You can get mercury-free vaccines in this country. Unfortunately, people in the rest of the world, in the developing world, Africa, Asia, Latin America, don't have that choice. In 2004, there was a study that EPA or CDC has relied on to tell people that vaccines are safe. And the primary author of that study was a man named Bill Thompson. It was called the DiStefano study. Mm-hmm. And the primary author is a 17-year senior scientist at CDC. In August, he came forward and filed for whistleblower protection, handed 100,000 pages of documents, incriminating documents on CDC corruption, over to Congress. And he now says, and those documents show, that study was a lie. That, in fact, one of the striking parts of that study is what they found is that kids who were black boys who were given the vaccine at age 3 and earlier, which is the time that CDC recommends, mm-hmm. had a 250% greater chance of getting an autism diagnosis than kids who than black boys who waited slightly. So what Bill Thompson said is that he was ordered by his boss, Frank DiStefano, he and the four other scientists on this study, to come into a room, take all the data on black kids, put it in a trash can, and destroy it. Hmm. And they published that document and pretended that there was no link. And because of that study, mm-hmm. 5,000 cases in vaccine courts where parents claimed that their kids had gotten autism from vaccines were dismissed. And there's been 100,000 black kids, mostly boys, 41 boys, who have gotten autism since then, where it may have been prevented.
And this is what year?
This was 2004.
So I want to come to you, Professor, yeah. because what Robert Kennedy is saying to us is that this is what happened in 2004. That right. scientists took data
yeah.
and were ordered to throw it in the trash can, data right. that could have saved the lives or certainly prevented black boys and others from getting certain diseases. This is 2004. How do black people or poor people ever come to trust science or government?
So I think it's critically important to distinguish between concerns about a particular additive in mm-hmm. a specific vaccine and vaccines in general. Mm-hmm. I think the concern is because the fact is that, you know, we are beneficiaries of polio vaccine, The rest of the world isn't. We're beneficiaries of measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. We benefit from several generations of young people who've grown into adulthood never having to worry about these illnesses. And so it's important that when, even if you ask critical questions about the science underpinning vaccine safety or the process that brings a vaccine into existence, that you don't use that as a way of undermining confidence in vaccines in general, because I think ultimately that's a terrible disservice to the population at large, because what you don't want is a population that tends to be under-immunized to say, well, I'm not going to go in this direction. I mean, the trends are that, you know, African-Americans, Hispanic-Americans tend to have fewer immunizations, notwithstanding what you've just said. So I think it requires, you know, a level of, I would say, health information and health literacy.
But that's my question. What I hear Robert Kennedy saying is that, if I can paraphrase it, it's not either or, to your point, it's both and.
That's right.
So the vaccines are good. We agree on that. I heard him say, we agree on the vaccines are good.
Right.
But again, so it's not either or, it's both and. Not all vaccines are good. Some of these vaccines possess thimerosal. So when you say what we need is good science, we need good information, how does the public get access to that? What agency do poor and black people have to get the truth?
Talk about, because I want to connect to the history. You know that you're very familiar with the Tuskegee experiment.
Sure.
In 1932, the predecessor organization, the CDC, took 299 black sharecroppers from the South who had syphilis. They offered them free health care, hot lunches, and free burial. They said, you can only come to us for health care. These were men who were sharecroppers, and they had syphilis. They were never told they had syphilis. Most of them tried to join up as soldiers during World War II. The CDC told the Pentagon not to let any of them in because you couldn't get in the military unless you were checked for syphilis. And in 1947, when penicillin was found to cure all syphilis, they were prevented from using penicillin because they wanted to see what would happen to them if they were in to the end. In 1966, a black man named Peter Buxton, who worked for CDC, a PhD, found out about this. And for 6 years, he begged and pleaded and screamed with all of the health agencies. He even went to the American Medical Association. They all rejected him. In 1972, he went to my uncle, Senator Edward Kennedy, who held hearings and brought the Tuskegee experiment to an end. By then, most of these men had died. 40 of their wives had contracted syphilis. 19 babies had congenital syphilis because they had let this happen. They said, we will never do this again. Then in 1991, the CDC came into South Central Los Angeles with an experimental flu vaccine, MMR vaccine. That was five times the potency of any vaccine ever given, and they gave it to black children. At the same time, only black children. At the same time, it was an untested and unapproved vaccine. The same time they were giving it to kids in Ghana, Liberia, and Haiti. So they were only experimenting on black children. What they found is that it was killing girls, lots of them, in agonizing deaths. And so they discontinued it in 2 years, but they kept it secret until 1996. They said, we'll never do it again. Yeah. And in 2004,
they did it again with thimerosal.
They do it again.
But this is my question. If we want the science to speak, but how do we know that the science we're getting is real? And how can black people and poor people all these years later ever come to trust the information?
So the relationship between science, medicine, and race is fraught.
Sure.
It's always been fraught. It's important to distinguish between the science of clinical testing, which has historically taken advantage of people. The case of Tuskegee is a case of denial of care. That is to say, putting a boundary between, you know, you have penicillin here, but you want to deny care to these poor black men in Macon County, right? The issues that we're talking about here have to do with African Americans who are denied care still.
Sure.
That is to say, I understand the concerns about immunization, but the goal in the current society is not to put barriers between people in immunization. It's actually quite the opposite. I think we're in a situation now where we have resegregated society, right? Most of the inequalities in health have to do with race-based residential segregation. Mm-hmm. That's why we have lead poisoning. That's why we have asthma rates the way we do. That's why we have diabetes. That's why, and even when you get to the hospital, you have more difficulty getting analgesic medicines for African Americans. Mm-hmm. That is to say, their pain is routinely underestimated. So I don't think we're in a society where what we want to do is to condone increasing skepticism about the healthcare system. We want to press the healthcare system to attention.
I get that, but nobody's condoning skepticism.
Right.
I make a decision, you know, a distinction between skepticism and cynicism.
Right.
What we're talking about is not cynicism. This is legitimate skepticism.
Well, you know, there is legitimate skepticism on a wide range of topics.
Sure.
What I would say,
but health is about life or death, though.
Yeah, you know, so
this isn't politics or economics. Those are important. This is life or death.
Yeah, you know, there's the work I did on sickle cell disease. You know, the main challenge was people going into the emergency room with pain and having physicians and nurses and healthcare practitioners not believing that they were really in pain and not really needing healthcare at that moment. All right. So to me, that's what I've been sort of focused on in my own work, which is the denial of care.
Right.
Which is the problem in Tuskegee as well. That is the denial of care in service of studying rather than acting.
But, you know, you have, I mean, what we see in this area is, you know, is endemic, which is that there's a healthcare system and there's healthcare regulators who have turned this into a two-class system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay to experiment on one class, and it's okay to deny health care to one class, and it's okay to give bad vaccines to one class, and, you know, and then, you know,
everybody
the rest of us.
I'm out of time. Let me remind you that Robert Kennedy's new book is called Thimerosal, Let the Science Speak. And the new book from Professor Keith Wailoo is called Pain, A Political History. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Our special on the Covenant with Black America 10 years later continues now. Our topic, Reclaiming Our Democracy. Pleased to be joined by Lisa Garza, co-creator of Black Lives Matter, and Rashad Robinson, executive director of Color of Change. Honored to have you both on.
Thanks for having us.
Let me start by saying thank you to you and all of your cohorts and colleagues in this Black Lives Matter movement who really, I think, advanced the conversation, raised the bar, pushed the envelope, pick your metaphor in 2015. That, in part, is the spirit of the conversation we're having this week. So thank you, and Rashad, for the work you continue to do at Color of Change. Thank you. For those who don't know the story, I mean, because Black Lives Matter was everywhere last year and so hotly debated everywhere, very quickly, just tell me the story, the genesis of how it began, for those who don't know the beginnings of the story.
Sure.
Yeah.
Black Lives Matter was created in 2013 after Trayvon Martin's killer was acquitted of his murder. And essentially, Black Lives Matter started as a love note that I wrote to black people on Facebook. Mm-hmm. My sister Patrice put a hashtag in front of it so that people could follow the conversation. And my sister Opal created a series of social media platforms for people to be able to connect online to be able to get together offline to fight back against anti-black racism. Mm-hmm. Since then, we've developed into much more than a hashtag. We are a network of more than 30 chapters internationally.
Mm. Rashad, Fast Company, as I recall, listed and honored Color of Change as one of the most innovative organizations doing this kind of social justice work. Tell me how the fight for justice in America has changed over the last couple of years, how it's become more innovative, more creative. I mean, this we love Dr. King, he's our hero, but this ain't King's generation. Protest has taken on a different form, a different flavor. How do you see that?
Well, I see, you know, in so many ways, we're overlaying technology to old organizing tactics, the tactics of developing a strategy, identifying an opportunity, and being able to bring people power energy to everyday causes. At Color of Change, we think very clearly about how do we take the presence that black people have in the world, the awareness of our issues, trending on social media, front pages of newspapers, and not mistake that awareness, that presence, for power. How do we translate cultural presence to cultural power? And we do that by building energy, by building movements, by identifying moments that are happening in the world and giving people something clear to do. And amplifying that energy, holding corporations and holding government officials accountable.
When we did this original book, The Covenant of Black America, 10 years ago, one of the 10 covenants was the digital divide. And the gap was so broad 10 years ago. So this year, the 10th anniversary of that book, The Covenant of Black America, 10 years later, we go back to look at the progress made or lack thereof over the last 10 years since the historic groundbreaking covenant. Where the digital divide is concerned, the gap has shrinked, but it's nuanced. The gap has shrunk only because black people now in mass have access to smartphones. So because everybody can actually access the internet, the divide has shrunk in that regard. But it really hasn't shrunk because most black folk can still not afford a computer in their home. There's only so much homework, so much you can accomplish on an actual cell phone. So the divide has shrunk, but not really. I raise that to ask how you think social media, how access to the internet is changing the way we raise issues.
I think it's absolutely changing. You know, we have these new platforms that allow us to speak with an unfiltered voice, to go directly to our politicians or go directly to those in power and demand things. Mm-hmm. But I do think that just like the old media platforms, you know, of mm-hmm. the 50s and the 60s and the 80s and the 90s, we have to be concerned about who owns them, about our own ownership and our mm-hmm. own access, and not confuse our voice on the Twitters or the Facebooks for a solely unfiltered voice. These are Silicon Valley platforms that don't even hire black folks. Mm-hmm. So we have to be, you know, in our words, a color of change. We have to be as powerful offline as we mm-hmm. are online. And we have to think about, you know, how are we connecting with the Black Lives mm-hmm. Matter chapters? How are we connecting with people in communities raising their voices? And how are we overlaying technology, but not putting all of our eggs in one basket?
At the start of this year, 2016, Alicia, I wonder if there is a way, and if so, I'd love to do it on our show, a way to finally put to rest this debate about Black Lives Matter versus All Lives Matter. I'm so over this, I think, silly debate about phraseology and terminology on the one hand. On the other hand, words matter. I'm a mm-hmm. wordsmith, and I get that. What say you, as one of the founders, about this debate about Black Lives Matter versus All Lives Matter, whatever other interpretations people have?
Right, and I'm so glad you asked, yeah. because it's a question we get asked a lot. The reality is all lives do matter. Mm-hmm. We care about humanity across the world, and we also live in a world where all lives don't actually matter in practice, mm-hmm. right? So saying all lives matter is a way to speak to our aspirations for what we want the world to look like, mm-hmm. but we live in a world where all lives don't matter. We live in a world where every 28 hours, a black person is murdered by police, security guards, or vigilantes. We live in a world where black trans women have a life expectancy of 35 years old. So given that, we can't say that all lives matter in practice. Mm-hmm. But if we want to get to that place where all lives matter, then we have to fight like hell for black lives today.
This coming Sunday, the 17th of January, there's a Democratic debate, another one of those six debates that they're having. In Charleston, South Carolina, the topic will be, I suspect, black issues, at least to some degree. Let's hope so. I want to ask you about that in a second since you said okay. that. Lester Holt of NBC is moderating that debate. It's sponsored by the Congressional Black Caucus. So to your point, we hope that some black issues will get discussed this Sunday in this debate with the Democrats in Charleston, South Carolina. I raise that because you all, one of your chapters, pushed Bernie Sanders really hard in 2015 on this issue of Black Lives Matter and other attendant issues. Mm-hmm. You've met with Hillary Clinton on these issues. How are you seeing the race start to frame, at least on the Democratic side, around the issues that are important to Black Lives Matter?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that had there not been an intervention at Netroots Nation mm-hmm. where Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders were called to task for saying absolutely nothing about the severe crises facing black communities in this country mm-hmm. and around the world. If that intervention had not happened, I'm not clear that we would be seeing as much dialogue about race mm-hmm. in the presidential elections as we are now. And the fact of the matter is we still have a long way to go. It took pushing for Senator for Senator Sanders
sure.
to even be able to say, yes, I believe Black Lives Matter. Certainly Martin O'Malley's response was that white lives matter and all lives matter. And then certainly Clinton's response was that Black Lives Matter. But then, of course, we've been having this whole debate around, you know, what's more important, changing hearts or changing mm-hmm. policy, mm-hmm. when those of us who've been in this work for a long time understand that they're in dialectical relationship mm-hmm. to one another. Mm-hmm. And as Rashad said earlier, we can't mistake presence for power, but we also have to make sure that we're changing the culture in which new and better mm-hmm. laws can take effect and be implemented.
I assume you were pleased, but how pleased were you with the way that students on college campuses specifically, I mean, Black Lives Matter, a lot of young folk involved, to be clear, and I want to make sure that we acknowledge that this is a young people's movement, and so it's bottom up, which I celebrate. But specifically on college campuses, I don't want to start calling the campuses because there's so many that come to mind, but everybody, of course, knows Mizzou yes. and what happened there. But how do you read what happened on campuses this year where Black students are concerned?
Well, we know that campuses have traditionally been a hotbed for activism. Mm-hmm. It's where people are getting exposed to new people and new ideas. But certainly, I think with the last 2 years around Black Lives Matter, what's happened is that we've created space for people's experiences of blackness to become more visible and to translate themselves into tangible demands mm-hmm. that can create change in various sectors in our society. And the university is a perfect place for that to happen. Black students have been talking for a long time about feeling excluded and marginalized, not seeing ourselves represented in curriculum, facing hostile campus climates. And so the upsurge that we saw in campus activism, I think, really reflects mm-hmm. A feeling of not just nihilism, right, and, mm-hmm. and a way to talk about the exclusion, mm-hmm. but also really represents the best of, I think, what our country has to offer, which is yeah. what happens when young people get in motion and start to articulate a vision for a new world.
Rashad, here's a factoid for you that I think I knew, but it really knocked me on my behind when I actually saw it in black and white. $1 circulates in Asian communities for a month. $1 in Jewish communities circulates for 20 days. $1 in the white community writ large circulates for 17 days. I ask you, how many days does $1 circulate in the black community? It ain't days, pardon my English. 6 hours. 6 hours $1 circulates in the black community. I raise that, Rashad, because I want to ask, how do we hold other people accountable where these issues are concerned if we don't first hold ourselves responsible? And how do you interpret that fact?
Yeah, I think that that's a really sad fact and speaks mm-hmm. to institutional racism, everything from how our culture and our economy was stolen from us through slavery to all the barriers that were put in front of black people and growing businesses. And then what we are currently dealing with the ways in which corporate power mm-hmm. controls our everyday lives, from our political system to our communities, from the bank system to the consumer marketplace. And all of those systems collude with our politics mm-hmm. to create a system that makes it incredibly hard for black people to gain any type of power. How do we hold our politics, our political, mm-hmm. you know, system accountable? Democrats, as much as Republicans, mm-hmm. are at fault for this. How do we build the type of powerful movements that force people to be accountable? And that's what we're doing at Color of Change. It's why we don't take any big corporate money at Color of Change. It's mm-hmm. because we want to be able to speak with an open, unfiltered mm-hmm. voice, but we want to hold, you know, politicians as accountable as we hold corporations. The marches of the 60s were about demand. Demanding government stand mm-hmm. up. The marches and the work and the fighting today, whether it be online or offline, has to be about changing our economic system so that black people are able to mm-hmm. express their buying power
but
in different ways.
I agree with you. But yeah. to your point, for all that we agree on, yeah. given what you've just said, with all due respect to the Obama administration, one of the things I think that many of us in the progressive community agree on is they failed miserably when it came to holding, or when it's come to holding corporate America, Wall Street, accountable. Mm-hmm. With all due respect to my friend Eric Holder, nobody went to jail on Wall Street for all the crimes that were committed. People paid billion-dollar fines, and they wrote most of that off. But nobody has been held accountable on Wall Street. So I'm trying to get your sense of, you know, how we accomplish that
yeah.
if those who represent us don't take the issue seriously that they have to be held accountable to?
I think it's been one of the true failures of our civil rights infrastructure of holding government accountable during these last 7 years in the ways that we should. And it's why I'm so proud to be standing with folks like Alicia and others in this next generation civil rights movement, which are interested and focused on holding Democrats just as accountable as we hold Republicans for the failures of our system to adequately respond to the needs and concerns. You know, Color of Change started in the aftermath of a flood where Black people were literally on their roofs in the Gulf Coast begging for help. And we said, George Bush doesn't care about Black people. Mm-hmm. And we heard that from Kanye. Mm-hmm. We heard that repeated over and over again. The question is how do we change the written and unwritten rules of government and of our politics to ensure that whether people care about Black people or not, they have no choice but to listen to us. They have no choice but to respond to us. And so you're right. No one went to jail, and we saw folks from the Occupy movement being charged and facing charges, and we saw no one being charged. We see folks from Black Lives Matter facing charges and trumped up charges, but folks who literally crashed our marketplace and stole generations of Black wealth, left Black people without their homes and their resources that they had fought to build through Jim Crow and before. We have work to do as a movement. And we can't do it on the backs of corporate money. We can't do it on the backs of the old ways that we were building our organizations.
So, Alicia, when this book came out, The Covenant, 10 years ago, it wasn't about Barack Obama because it came out in 2006.
That's right.
He didn't show up to 2008. It was about him. This book, 10 years later, The Covenant, is not about Obama. It's about the state of our community 10 years later. So his name is barely mentioned in the text. So it's not about him. There'll be plenty of books written about what he did or didn't do on his watch. I might write one, but this ain't that book. This book is about the state of Black America. Mm-hmm. So to the point Rashad is making now, I wonder how you think history, how will the historians juxtapose, balance these two realities? That in the era of the first Black president, the bottom fell out of Black America. In the era of the first Black president, Black Lives Matter had to come into existence because Black men and boys and girls, women being shot in the streets. In the era, you take my point. Mm-hmm. How the historians, you think, going to juxtapose that reality, those two realities down the road?
Well, certainly it depends on who the historian is. Mm-hmm. And hopefully those historians will be people from our generation who have been on the front lines of these fights, trying to navigate this contradiction of what it means to be Black under the administration of the first and maybe the last Black president that this country will ever have, right? Mm-hmm. But I do think that one of the things that we would want to make sure gets communicated about how we tried to close that gap is that we brought together people who were directly impacted, people who loved Black people so fiercely and believed in our potential and our power that we literally did what we needed to do to hold accountable the people who refuse to move an agenda that benefits us, right? And that we also placed people in power mm-hmm. who felt that they were accountable to our movements. Mm-hmm. That's the history that we want to be able to tell.
And the issue of the moment, this issue of guns, I don't want to color the question too much, pardon the pun. How do you see this issue playing out the way it is these days?
This issue of guns.
Guns, where black folk are concerned. Mm-hmm. Black folk are being killed by guns, being killed with guns. I mean, you can play the semantics.
Yeah.
Guns don't kill people. People kill. But that's such a plague in the Black community. The gun violence.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a couple different dynamics to mm-hmm. that debate, and one part of that debate is that Black people are never a part of it. Mm-hmm. So it's being framed and it's being shaped mm-hmm. By folks who are still very invested in this notion mm-hmm. of the right to bear arms, which was really about stealing land, mm-hmm. right, and stealing resources from people who already lived here to create something that was only really a shadow of mm-hmm. the vision that they espoused. The other piece of that reality, right, is that as long as our communities have more access to guns than we do to a quality education, than we do to resources and family wealth, yeah. than we do to a sound quality of life, we're going to continue to see a loss of Black life in front of and behind guns, whether that be at the hands of the police yeah. or sometimes at the hands of our own community members.
15 seconds, Rashad. If there's anything that makes you hopeful about the year to come where these matters concerning our lives are concerned. What is that?
It is, you know, when I talked about presence to power, mm-hmm. and we've got this moment where we have deep presence and awareness because of the work of so many on the ground, online, in the media. And now it's our opportunity to translate that presence mm-hmm. into power. And I'm hopeful that we've got so many amazing and talented activists ready to take that up.
We thank Rashad Robinson and Alicia for being here and for your work in the past and for what you're going to do this year.
Thank you.
Appreciate having both of you here. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. We turn now to the state of education and its resulting impact on the economy and African-American communities. Pleased to be joined by economist, President Emerita of Bennett College and author of Are We Better Off? Race, Obama, and Public Policy, Dr. Julianne Malveau, and former Assistant Secretary, that is, for Civil Rights at the Department of Education, Russ and Allie. Good to have you both on the program.
Good to be here, Davis.
Let me jump right in because my time is tight, but I wanted to link the economy and education in this conversation tonight as we talk about the covenant 10 years later. One of the things that's abundantly clear in this text, The Covenant, and in your book, Dr. Malveau, Are We Better Off Yet, is that, sad to say, black people have lost ground in every leading economic category over the last decade. In every, not one, two, or three, but in every leading economic category, black folk have lost ground over the last decade. What do you make of that?
Part of it, Tavis, is the recession. We basically saw things spiraling out of control in 2008, 2007, 2008. This is a Bush recession, and President Obama, of course, had the challenge of trying to bring us out of it. So the recession was a big part. We saw poverty go up. We saw income levels go down. We saw more bifurcation. Indeed, the people who earn less than $15,000 a year, that proportion went up. And the proportion who earn more than $200,000 a year went up uh-huh. slightly, which meant that that middle, again, you see mm-hmm. top of the bottom, more bifurcation. But part of it is the recession, but part of it, quite frankly, has been discrimination. And we've seen a resurgence of discrimination, frankly, as President Obama has led us. You have people who are not hiring people of African descent. You have people who are making it more difficult. The president himself addressed the issue. Would you rather give the job to James or Jamal, I think was the dichotomy he used. And a lot of people have race fatigue. They won't talk about it. They don't believe it's there anymore. Mm-hmm. Wealth, of course, is an accumulation. So the wealth indicator is one of the ones that's really very frightening. When you look at the fact that in 2007, I believe, blacks had about 10% of the wealth of whites. Now it's about 7%. So the proportion of wealth went down. And again, part of it recession, part of it discrimination, part of it lack of access to capital. Mm-hmm. We know all the answers. The question is what we do about them.
This was supposed to, I mean, I don't think Russell bought into this and you didn't. I know I didn't. We'll come to Russell in a second here. But this was supposed to be, many people thought, a post-racial era that we were going to be ushered into because of the election of one Barack Obama. How is it that race can still be the mitigating factor that it is in employment and education in this era?
What I think you got was a big backlash among many whites. I don't know if you saw the recent poll, the RAGE surveys, mm-hmm. where they found that white people were angrier than African-American people. Mm-hmm. And they basically were working class whites who were angrier. And I think that many of them take their anger out on black folks. They think that we're the enemy. Or you see what Mr. Trump is getting in when he makes these comments about immigrants, he gets rounds of applause. So the fact that there is a black president does not mean, you know, that that's a symbol. Mm-hmm. And there has not been the substance to back it up often. But additionally, essentially, the presence of a black president has angered some people to the point that their racism is showing.
Every president, Ruslan, says that he or maybe she, who knows, in a year from now, he or she wants to be the education president. One way, mm-hmm. shape, or form, they make that claim. Progress has been made in, you know, when one gets inside the covenant,
sure.
they'll see that progress has been
sure.
made in certain areas. But the gap
yes.
is still so, that achievement gap
yes.
is still so broad. 10 years later,
yes.
what do you make of that?
Well, the gaps, right?
Uh-huh.
Because it is the achievement
Plural.
Gap.
Sure.
It is the graduation gap. Uh-huh. It is the access to rigorous courses gap, right?
Uh-huh.
If you attend a school that serves mostly black and brown students, you are only 39% as likely to have algebra 2 and calculus and physics, right? Yeah. Those courses we're going to need at a bare minimum. What Dr. Malveaux also indicated around 2007, I think one of the most striking statistics for me is that since 2007 to now, 70% of Black middle-class kids have achieved downward mobility, mm-hmm. right? This idea of the American dream, the upward mobility that this country has been founded on is gone for everybody, right? Mm-hmm. And we are feeling it more than any other race. Why? As indicated what doctors said earlier, I mean, you are dealing with the consequences of decades, not just mm-hmm. over the last 8 years or sure. 10 years, mm-hmm. decades of ensuring that poor kids and kids of color, especially African-American kids, get less of everything that we know makes a difference in public education, mm-hmm. right? We give them less of the great teachers that don't buy into what the former President Bush called soft bigotry of low expectations that mm-hmm. is not so soft, right? Mm-hmm. We give them less of the dollars. We give them less rigor. We give them less facilities. We give them less innovation, and we get less than stellar yeah. results.
Less resources, less computers. I mean, just like the list of less tablets is amazing when you look, when you compare an inner city school mm-hmm. to a suburban school in terms of what kind of resources they have, the number of computers per student. Mm-hmm. You basically are starting our kids off behind. Yeah. And then, you know, when they are able to go to college, the dollars aren't there anymore. So you've seen the numbers, the spiraling numbers mm-hmm. of debt. The average student graduated with about $30,000 worth of debt. Now, interestingly, about half of all students don't have any debt, which means that you're really talking about the average student with debt
sure.
having about $60,000 sure. mm-hmm. worth of debt.
Sure. The only thing I'd say, though, is increasingly, we are more and more in suburban schools. And those suburban schools that used to be great are becoming less great.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, but looking at Pell and the college, the whole college situation, you know, which as a former college president, it frightens me mm-hmm. to see how much debt young people are taking on, sure. which then when you talk about what we end up with in terms of wealth, et cetera, those things are connected.
Let me go back to public education right yeah. quick. And I'll start with you, Wesley, and Dr. Malveaux can chime in if she wants. But I was just curious to do some research for this conversation. And, of course, editing and compiling The Covenant, I had to do that anyway.
Of course.
The first Black public high school, first Black public high school yes. in the country, Dunbar,
yes.
as
yes.
we all know in Washington,
yes.
D.C. Back in the day, late 1800s, Dunbar was kicking behind.
Yeah.
And those Black students at Dunbar were out-testing white people.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
Yes.
Something happened.
Yes.
Why is it that in the late 1800s, Black folk were doing remarkably yeah. well in a Black public school, and yeah. now the numbers are, as you and Dr. Malveaux mm-hmm. have described? What happened?
Well, to be sure, Dunbar was the exception even back then,
right?
right? We
okay.
can look at the all-Black schools in Texas, for example, Willie Brown School, mm-hmm. where only one mm-hmm. went to college, right? So that kind of success that we saw at Dunbar, we saw for elite African-Americans, we have seen that for elite African-Americans throughout history, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't want to take the outlier that was then
sure, sure, sure.
and make it the norm.
Okay.
Truth is, we still have those same kind of outliers today. But a lot obviously has transpired since then. While we have seen greater graduation rates, more college attainment, the things that we know contribute to upward mobility greater than, we've also, as we've just talked about, seen less of everything. Throughout the 80s, we had a deep cut in all things that mattered when it came to schools and social services, right? This idea that schools are a reflection of community, they ought to be the hub of community. We have cut everything that matters in them, and now we hold them to higher standards
guess,
than we ever
I
had
guess
before.
What troubles me, though, Dr. Malveaux, is that Black people, not surprisingly, are getting the short end of the stick on both ends. That is to say that Black students have less and less access to an equal high quality education
mm-hmm.
on the one end.
Yes.
But on the other end, as you noted earlier, Black wealth has evaporated. So if there's a link between the two,
right.
education
it's
and
exactly
economy,
right.
and you're losing on both ends, what gives?
Not much.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're looking at the African-American community, unless there are interventions, Tavis, we can continue to see the downward spiral, as Wrestling has talked about, in terms of downward mobility.
Right.
We've never, ever in our country talked about everybody thought your son is going to do better mm-hmm. than you are.
Yeah, sure.
Your grandson is going to mm-hmm. do better than your son did. Now it's sort of like people are frightened that the sons are not going to do better. Their daughters aren't going to do better.
70%, Doctor, 70% of African Americans have the bottom two quintiles after the middle class mm-hmm. since 2007.
Yeah.
70% downward mobility.
Yeah.
And with the wealth piece, with the education piece, we can only expect to see that spiral further down, again, unless there are interventions. Now, the challenge is that no one wants to believe that we need interventions. So people are unwilling to do the very minimum, such as affirmative action, or things that are much more maximal, such as public programs, to allow people to build wealth. And there are ways that through public policy we could build wealth, but we are sitting in an era where people want to streamline government as opposed to augment government. Mm-hmm. And streamlining really means taking money from the poor and giving it to the wealthy.
The best thing that I think one of the best things, and I want to get your take on this, one of the best things that Jesse Jackson Jr., a former congressman who just served his time, did when he was in Congress, and I hated to see him go through that because I thought this was a powerful piece of legislation. And it was little by little gaining traction every year in Congress that he was there. But he had a simple proposal. And obviously, no constitutional amendment is ever simple because it takes two-thirds of the states to ratify. Yeah. We get all that. But the notion was simple, that every child in this country, every child, deserved access to an equal, high-quality education.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Now, speaking of intervention, that it seems, my grandmother would say, it's too much like right. It just makes too much sense. But how do we get to a place where we can guarantee that we want gun rights for people and free speech rights, but how do you guarantee every child in this country access, not judging outcomes, but access to an equal, high-quality education?
That's a dollars thing, Tavis, and that's going to be the challenge. The amendment, quite frankly, Jesse Jr., is brilliant. Yeah. I mean, he's had a number of other things to talk about in terms of access. His dad wrote a book years ago about financial literacy. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, just a brilliant mind thinking about one of the things we see as a right. And you're right. These people with their guns will throw down about their guns, sit up in Oregon about land. But where is the person who's going to say, you know, we've got to have better education? Saying it isn't enough. You've got implementation requires dollars. And there is nobody's heart putting dollars into poor children. It's not black children, poor children. No one wants to put that dollar in the game. And so if the dollars aren't there, the quality schools are not going to be there. Look at our inner city schools. Some of them are shameful. You go in and the buildings are dilapidated, crumbling. You wouldn't go to office like that. Mm-hmm. Neither would I.
Well,
so why do you go to a school like that?
And let's be clear. We already have really strong laws that aren't enforced. Mm-hmm. Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act does exactly that. Right. It says that
where is the
enforcement of it, and where are the dollars? It's also when you talk about public policy, we have to decide as a country that we're going to teach. We're going to teach. We have teachers in schools every day serving our kids. They need supports to get better, and our kids need the resources they need to be able to succeed more. But
and the needs. We need smaller classrooms.
Sure.
We need fewer students. But again, everything. You're much more experienced than I am from the policy perspective of the Department of Education. But what I see it from an economic perspective is it all rolls back to money, and there is no political will to educate especially children of color, poor
yes,
children.
You know,
there is no political
It's political
will
and it's civic will. It is certainly about resources, but it is as much as how we spend those dollars as it is more money in the pot.
How would you
the
spend differently?
We need a whole lot more than 20 minutes for that. For sure, it is about ensuring that the kids that need the most get the most. It is about ensuring that they get access to the best and brightest teachers. It is about ensuring that the teachers in those schools get the extra supports that they need to succeed. And we have had nothing but recalcitrance, not from federal government, but also from local players, from special interest, the voices that get lost. Look, when we're talking about public education, you're talking about over 50 to 55% of every state's budget, right? Mm-hmm. K-16. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of special interest. Those that we do not listen to are the voices of young people and their parents and community members that actually know a lot about what it'll take to
really
make their school succeed.
When you look at books,
right.
That's a really good point because there are few publishing companies who are doing all the books, Tavis, for our schools, and
Talk
some
about
of them
a monopoly,
and some of them just tell bold-faced lies. Slavery were the voluntary workers.
Yeah.
Now they did get rid of that book, but I mean, how do you with a quasi-monopoly have a book like that?
Let me shift gears just a little bit because we've been talking about. Let me just go to the black college you mentioned earlier, and I mentioned in my introduction that you are the president emeritus of a black college for women named Bennett, and Russell Minter Spelman, another black college for women.
There are only two, actually.
Yeah, right. Only two. Yeah, yeah.
Another.
Another one, yeah. The other one.
Yes.
Okay, I take that. But one of the things that I think tripped up the Obama administration was this, I think, huge mistake they made regarding black colleges and the way they were going to help fund these students getting through. I'll let you tell the story, but just tell the quick story, because it's covered a bit in the book, how that happened and what the outcome of that was and why that mistake was made.
Well, there were several mistakes made. When President Obama came in, the previous president, Mr. Bush, had set aside $850 million. It was to be divided among the 105 HBCUs. Mm-hmm. Initially, President Obama said he was going to move that. And you didn't, however. but Russell, let's be clear. It set a tone with HBCU presidents and others that we don't care. Now, and it took a lot of nemesis, and it took a lot of effort on our part to turn that around. So we're supposed to be doing something else. We're doing that. But then time passes.
Well, can we just add to this that in lieu for minority serving institutions, so it's not to say that those resources were ever intended or even in rhetoric to go to non-students of color, right? It was about, given the historical designation of what we consider HBCUs and how many are not. Spelman is not considered an HBCU, right? Under
actually,
those technical, for the 104 that get
yes.
resources under the law.
Spelman is considered.
It's, there are several that are both solely African-American serving and those that are largely that otherwise did not get counted.
My question is, why did this become a fight, and why did the black college presidents end up going to Washington to push back on this decision?
Basically, we felt marginalized.
Yeah.
It became a fight because I frankly don't think that the president was, I'm glad that you were in the administration, but I think there was a tone deafness about HBCUs. The second thing that happened, and this may be the time that we really did make headlines, Parent PLUS Loan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was profound neglect on the part of the administration.
Profound or benign?
No, profound.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it wasn't benign.
Yeah.
And Mr. Duncan, then the Secretary of Education, had the temerity to say he apologized for the imposition of Parent PLUS. Well, how do you apologize when 28,000 HBCU students cannot enroll? So you apologize, but you don't roll it back. Now, they did roll back little. But basically, we lost lots of students because most HBCUs are tuition-driven, which means if students are not there, we have small endowments. If students are not there, that money you can't pay faculty, utilities, et cetera. It was not a change in the law. It was a change in the application of the law. So the law had always been there. They just chose to apply it differently and not to let people know, Tavis, so that you come back to school in August thinking you have your loan
and
you don't have it.
Let me close with this. I want to give you the first stab, Russell, in the minute or so I have left. Were this link, I mean, there's no doubt about the link between education and economic opportunity.
Sure.
That link is clear.
For sure.
Where black people are concerned, is there anything right now, given all the ugliness of the data, that makes you hopeful about our future, where that link is concerned?
That the great equalizer that we were intended to be, I believe that schools will still have the same hope. I believe that we have gotten so bad that for our country to be any resemblance of the land of opportunity we have no choice but to fix
but
this.
Education
and
to,
I will tell you, the demographic imperative is what gives me hope.
Okay.
For the first time this year, we are majority-minority in our public schools.
Right.
It is about meeting the needs, us as them.
I accept that, but I close on this note. Is education, though, the great equalizer for us that it used to be?
No, it's less of an equalizer than it used to be, I believe. And while you talk about the shifted demographic, the fact is while the children are majority minority, the administrators and the others are not. And so you basically have, just like you have in the rest of the country, you have progress, but the progress very much is at the bottom. What gives me hope, Tavis, is not necessarily education, but quite frankly, the entrepreneurship that I see coming from many young people. And I will say, I believe that every young person, college student, should take an entrepreneurship class. I was proud to institute an entrepreneurship major when I was president at Bennett College. But young people need to know about entrepreneurship, need to be interested in it. African Americans are only a third as likely to own businesses as whites are.
Russell, thank you for your service in the Obama Administration Education Department. Good to have you on the program. Dr. Malvo's latest book is called Are We Better Off? Race, Obama, and Public Policy. Dr. Malvo, good to see you as always.
Thank you.
Covenant with Black America 10 years later, available everywhere books are sold right now.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Our special on the Covenant with Black America 10 years later continues now. Our topic, the environment. So pleased to be joined by environmental advocate Erin Brockovich, famously played by Julia Roberts, who won the Academy Award for Best Actress for playing Erin Brockovich, and our dear friend Wendell Pierce, best known for his roles in HBO's The Wire and Tremé, and author of a new book. It's called The Wind in the Reeds, A Storm, A Play, and The City That Would Not Be Broken. Good stuff, Wendell. Good to have you back on the program.
Good to be on the show.
Erin, I want to come back to communities of color across the country who get dumped on, literally. Mm-hmm. But it seems that I have to start with this story about Flint, Michigan.
Yes.
And we can talk about Porter Ranch, not too far from this studio, in fact. But let's start with Flint. What do you make of this story? Who knew what, when? How did this happen?
You know what? Flint has actually been a very disturbing story. Anytime there's an environmental situation, the name Erin Brockovich just kind of goes along and people will start emailing me. And we got involved, and I sent one of my investigators out there, and we started kind of like a Facebook campaign, if you will, with the community. And they, you know, they fascinated me, because once they really began to find out what was going on or who might be hiding something, whether it be the water officials, whether it be a state agency, whether it be their mayor, they very quickly got proactive and band together. And, you know, they ousted their mayor and they got a new mayor in place. And now this is a situation in Flint that is actually despicable. And as it backs up and we're starting to learn, there appears to be a lot of political corruption involved in what happened. And it's disturbing. Today, there was some news breaking out of Truthdig that, in fact, the governor had information and emails knowing 6 or 7 months ago, in fact, that this type of contaminated water was being delivered. And so this is something that's becoming all too common. And for a whole host of reasons, that we have agency failures, lack of oversight, no enforcement, and people are just getting away with this. And there's this old mentality, actually, that the solution to pollution is dilution. So whether we're talking about a water system that's gone bad, or we're talking about fluoride, or we're talking about chemicals that companies make, it gets into our river. We have to change that mentality. We have to change and work hard on old corporate behaviors and adopt a new model moving forward in this country. And we have to start really holding accountable, in my opinion, and I see it way too often, our politicians. It's a problem.
Let me jump from Flint right quick to California, to Porter Ranch again, just 45 minutes or an hour or so up the road from here with this leak. Your sense of that story?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'm heavily involved in that story. I'm actually their neighbor. I live over in Agoura Hills. And again, a situation that all of these things start as an onion. And as you peel back the layer, you start learning a little more and you start getting more information, and it starts getting a little stinkier along the way till you find out what really happened. The truth will always come out. And in Porter Ranch is a situation where we have this methane, this gas well that has been breached, and it is just billowing. I don't know if you've seen the photos of it. It looks like a volcano. Just billowing all of this gas to date. Now, Southern Cal Gas claims that this leak started October 23rd. It actually started before then. But to date, and they cannot shut it off, we call it the BP oil spill on land, has released by state agencies' own calculations, which is undercalculated, 187 million pounds of methane into the environment. And we keep going at this rate, which they say they can't shut it off till possibly the end of March. We're looking at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds of methane. Now, this community, that why we build communities on top of the second largest natural gas reserve in California, and we store there 5.5 billion cubic feet of gas under pressure, and we think that when there's a disaster that it's not going to impact the community or their health, drives me mad. And as we're learning, Southern Cal Gas knew in 1979 there was a safety valve on this critical well that would prevent this. They removed it and never replaced it. And they knew up to 5 years ago that this was an impending disaster, yet nobody stepped in to stop it.
Wendell, congrats again on The Wind in the Reeds.
Thank you very much.
When we wrote...
It's a good title.
It is a great title, yeah, and great book, too.
When we wrote this book, The Covenant, 10 years ago, laying out the 10 most pressing issues of concern to black people, the environment was clearly one of those 10 issues. 10 years later, there's a new book out that updates what we have or have not accomplished on the environment, specifically where black America is concerned. Mm-hmm. When you hear stories like Flint, when you hear stories like Porter Ranch, given where this story really starts, you know, this book came out in 2006, Katrina's right. 2005. Five. This book was a response to the fact that black lives didn't matter in, right. in 2006 in your hometown. Given you, so your vantage point, your prism, your perch is a little different. How from that perch do you see all of this?
First of all, you know, I was thinking today, how can I sit next to, you know, Aaron Brockovich yeah. and the Brockovich Foundation? Why would I be on this couch with her? And the fact is, there is a covenant that we have to make with the advocacy of the expertise that are there. And what I represent are just those communities that have to organize and come together mm-hmm. and actually take action on it. As an artist, you do your work so that we can sit in a room and decide on what our values are and then act on them. Mm-hmm. And it's that last step of saying we're going to act on what are at issue to our community to make sure we hold people accountable, like those politicians in Flint. I look at Flint, and it's now more than ever that the people of Flint have to use the blueprint of all of those social justice movements in the past, mm-hmm. and the new social justice movements of the present mm-hmm. to say, to hold those people accountable, because the 6 or 7 months that the lead have poisoned the people of Flint will poison their children for the rest of their lives. 6 months for 60 years of poisoning, mm-hmm. and people have to be held accountable. People have to be held, I think, criminally mm-hmm. accountable, mm-hmm. because it's mm-hmm. not something that couldn't be avoided. It was literally people not doing what's important to put the infrastructure in to protect the people of Flint. And so we, as a community in New Orleans, in response mm-hmm. to Katrina, said that we're going to have to be more more of an advocate to make sure that those who are bringing infrastructure now, post-Katrina, bringing resources now, have to bring those resources to our community to protect us from issues like Flint and what's happening in Porter Ranch.
You said two things I want to go back and pick up. First of all, I couldn't agree more, and I heard Aaron make a sound and nod her head when we were in unison on your point that people have to be held criminally liable. Mm-hmm. But you know they never are. In New Orleans, nobody mm-hmm. still has paid the price for all those precious lives that were lost. So I hear you saying that, but
and there was even a greater crime when the insurance companies were
precisely.
Allowed not to pay
yeah.
anything. Because we haven't been able to achieve that by holding people responsible doesn't mean that we have to give up our right to be our right to search for justice. Mm-hmm. It's a long continuum. Mm-hmm. It's an ongoing thing. Mm-hmm. Because we haven't been successful in the past doesn't mean we aren't going to be successful in the future or that we should give up the attempt of even doing it. We have to be persistent. You know, communities have to come together and be persistent. We had a situation in Puncher Train Park where we had a very good corporate partner wanted to come in and do recyclables mm-hmm. in the plant there. And all the landfills use their lobby and their money and their influence on the political class of New Orleans to shut it down, mm-hmm. you know, where we were actually had a community benefit agreement with the company where they're going to be do first source hiring from the community. They were going to do a environmental a recyclable program and education program at Southern University at New Orleans. It was something that was going to be mutually beneficial. And those who don't have our best interests at heart mm-hmm. said, no, we're going to stop it because it's all about money. And it's a persistent thing that communities have to be aware of, because we have to do is look at the past. East St. Louis with Monsanto mm-hmm. and the pollutants there. We know that it's happened in the past, and we have to be vigilant about making sure that it doesn't happen in the future and try to hold people accountable for when it's happening today.
So, Aaron, to Wendell's point, his reference to East St. Louis, we could go to New Orleans. We could do this all day long. You're the expert here, obviously. But and I'm not naive in asking this question, but I want to give you room to address this. Why is it, and this is detailed in the covenant, why is it that poor communities and black communities in particular are always the ones who get dumped on, literally?
That is concerning. And I believe that, you know, we look at, and you hit upon a word that really struck with me because I say it often, it's values. And it is, we've moved away from our principles and these values and these morals, these ethics, and this respect that we need to have with each other. And these poor communities, you oftentimes will get somebody in a place of power that thinks they can just disrespect them. They don't have to share information, and they just get set aside. And it is a problem that continues to go on. But I do believe that there is this covenant, and we are merging together again in a very new social form. I believe that all of us have had it with this disrespect, whether it be corruption, being set aside, thinking your life doesn't matter, thinking that your health and your welfare and disrespecting us in that regard is going to be okay. I am seeing it happening. We're having this conversation now. I'm seeing it happening in St. Louis, in whether it be in New Orleans, whether it be in Flint, across this country. People are starting to take back their voice. I've always believed that people can move the dial. I will continue to believe that they can do that. But they've had enough, and they are starting through social campaigns, through Twitter, through Facebook, through this new social world that we live in, taking charge again of their lives, their backyard, their health, their family, their safety, and stepping up, stepping out, being proactive, and speaking up and saying, it's enough.
But I have to say also to our communities that we have to be able to look at our contribution to this dysfunctional paradigm. Mm-hmm. When we're voting at 15%, 10%, when politicians know that there's not going to be any impact or any sort of accountability if I do something to our communities, because that community doesn't vote. Mm-hmm. New Orleans has reached an agreement with FEMA right now, mm-hmm. $2 billion. Now, 10 years after the fact, to make sure that infrastructure is brought back to the level that it needs to be brought back to protect the city and just bring it back to its feet. Now, we got to make sure that the resources are dispersed in an even-handed way mm-hmm. in New Orleans. Now, if those communities are not making sure that the pressure is being brought to bear to make sure that that happens, they're not going to feel any sense of responsibility or accountability. So we have to make sure, one, first by starting to vote. Mm-hmm. Secondly, the social justice movement of the 21st century is economic development. Find those corporate partners who come in and mm-hmm. say, listen, we're going to do it this way. Do a community benefit agreement, like we tried to do mm-hmm. with a recyclable company, and say, first source hiring from the community, you know, bring in training programs for the community. Also, we're going to be involved in whatever programs that you have with the EPA. Sure. That's the sort of proactive things that communities can do to make sure that this happens. Holding politicians and our elected officials to bear and finding corporate partners to say, hey, listen, we know bottom line is important to you. The two can coexist. We have a desire to be economically and environmentally healthy as a community, and we want to join that search for you.
Since Wendell raised this issue of politics, let me shift gears slightly here. Again, I keep saying all night, every night this week, this book, The Covenant, 10 years later, is not about Obama. It wasn't about Obama 10 years later on the publication mm-hmm. of the original text. But you can't talk about these issues without looking at the majority of that 10-year decade of 10 years overlapping with his presidency. So let me ask you a direct question, Aaron, if I can. There's been great debate, and there'll be great debate in the years to come, of whether Obama measured up or didn't measure up on his environmental promises and mm-hmm. commitments. I suspect that Exhibit A for him is going to be this climate change agreement. Mm-hmm. You agree with me, and how do you read that accomplishment on the part of the president?
Honestly, I haven't been overly happy with some of his environmental policies or his involvement. I'm sure he will come forward with the climate change. I think that, though, we're going to continue to have these issues. I mean, if you look at the Porter Ranch situation, a quarter of our greenhouse effects and our climate change is happening in one spill. Mm. And so there's still going to be these loopholes where somebody's going to get through and cheat the system again. Mm-hmm. So I haven't been overly happy. I think that we have absolutely failed, in my opinion, mm-hmm. in this country with our current environmental policies on our water issues. Our infrastructure is failing. Places like Flint, where children, this is American 2016. Yeah. and we're delivering non-potable poisoned water to our community. Yeah,
craziness. So if Obama didn't measure up, do you see anything on the political horizon in 2016 that makes you hopeful? And I ask that because Hillary Clinton respectfully went back and forth waffling on this Keystone Pipeline until she finally made a decision. But if Obama didn't do it for you, do you see anything that makes you hopeful on the horizon in this election year?
Candidate-wise?
Mm-hmm. Issue-wise?
No. I'm going to tell you what I am hopeful for. Okay. I spend so much of my time, and I know that you feel the same out in these communities, is the people now starting to recognize and helping their neighbors and informing their neighbors. And again, that covenant and bringing it all back and standing up strong. We think, and I tell people all the time, Superman's not coming to save us.
Right.
And we're starting to look to ourselves again, and we think it's coming from the top down. Mm-hmm. It needs to really begin here at home and build up from there, and getting communities to be involved with their local council. And you made a really good point about, you know, corporations are people too, they say, right? So mm-hmm. they can be a good neighbor. And I think that it's just come to a place, you know, for me, it's like, give me a hand. Mm-hmm. And let's help each other.
Making it mutually beneficial.
Absolutely.
When we put together our building, our community development corporation in the rebuilding of Pontchartrain Park, the first thing I said is, we're going to ask people to come back to what was a disaster zone, one of the deepest flooding in New Orleans. Let's make it a 21st century redevelopment. Let's make it, solar. Let's make it geothermal. And so mm-hmm. that's why we said this is going to be the upgrade of the homes. When we also negotiated with government to get those properties delivered back to us so that we can put them out there commercially, we're going to pay for them on the back end when we sell the property. We pay for the property. But here's the thing. We put in our building codes or demands to make sure that it's LEED certified, silver, gold, mm-hmm. even platinum. So there's benefit for the home buyer. So it makes it beneficial to be environmentally mm-hmm. protected mm-hmm. and being environmentally healthy as a community. It brings actually economic benefit, too, because you get the solar tax credits and all. So when you have dumping on the community, as you said, hold those people accountable. Then seek out those that you can go in partnership with and say that we're going to do something that's going to be beneficial to both of us, environmentally and economically.
10 years after the publication of the covenant, I don't want to lie to you. It's not a pretty picture of what has been accomplished vis-a-vis the environment. Always progress made in small steps, but not a lot to celebrate 10 years after the publication mm-hmm. of this text. Speaking of text, Wendell Pierce has a new book out. It's called The Wind and the Reeds, a story, a play, and the city that would not be broken. Aaron Brockovich always on the case. This year has not started off good with regard to environmental issues. No. From Porter Ranch to Flint, we will see if there's any reason in this election year to be hopeful on these issues. But Wendell and Aaron, good to have you on this program.
It's good to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. My pleasure.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Our special broadcast on the Covenant with Black America 10 years later continues now with a look at the criminal justice system. Please be joined by civil rights attorney and community advocate Connie Rice and director of the Schomburg Center in New York, Khalil Gibran Muhammad, who I just read is leaving there shortly later this year, in fact, to head to Harvard for a new position there. Congratulations, sir.
Thank you.
Honored to have you back on this program.
Thank you.
Connie, let me start by asking whether or not you think that we are headed in the right direction where the conversation about mass incarceration is concerned. 10 years ago, when we wrote the original book, The Covenant with Black America, this is a critical issue. 10 years later, on the publication of this update, a decade out, I'm not sure yet whether or not we're moving in the right direction regarding the issue of mass incarceration. Your thoughts?
Compared to 10 years ago, mm-hmm. we're in a better place, mm-hmm. and we're in a better place for the conversation nationally and within the Black community. But we're not in the right place. I just don't think we've come to terms with what we did. Mm-hmm. We decided that an entire echelon of the American population was never going to make it to the American table. And we just said, we're going to imprison them. And we did it en masse. And we've never done that before with any other population, except maybe Native Americans. But we didn't imprison them. We just slaughtered them. Mm-hmm. So I really think that to come to terms with this, maybe we don't need to come to terms with that. Maybe it's enough for people like us to know that. But what we do have to understand is the enormous amount of resources it's going to take to get those folks to the table. Otherwise, we're talking about an underclass that doesn't just have incarceration and prison to stop them, but it means that even the Black community has not welcomed them back, has not eased their transition back into the community, mm-hmm. into the economy. They're not there yet, and we are not doing it. It's not enough to give folks the right to vote
right.
if they don't have jobs. They have no prospects of any opportunity. And what do? They go back to selling drugs and go right back into the incarceration system. We're not doing it, Tavis.
So we'll get to the point in a moment here about holding them, the system, whoever they are, accountable. But I hear you making a different point or a point alongside that, which is the Black community's responsibility to them. Tell me more about how you see that playing out.
Well, you know me and the Black middle class have got a fight going on.
Yeah. Always. A perennial fight with bourgeois Negroes. But I'm in there with you, so go ahead. Yeah.
I'm not exactly the favorite of the middle class. I just think the Black middle class has a special duty. We owe a special duty. And it's not a burden that any of us wanted, but it's a burden that we have. And we're not the only folks who have that kind of burden. You can look at other tribes and what burdens their privileged folks have had. We're not living up to it. We are not doing enough for poor Black children. I'll just give you one example. We preside over the political systems that establish the policies that make their lives utter Hades, to be nice about it, okay? Let me give you an example. Do you know that 80% of children who are sold into sexual slavery are Black children? Those are our children. Do you know where they come from, Tavis? They come from our foster care systems. Do you know who presides over those foster care systems? Middle-class Blacks. Our politicians. Our folks. So what I'm saying is that even where we have direct responsibility, we're not doing the job, and we have an indirect responsibility to claim our underclass, to say that they are the last vestige of slavery. That is the last vestige of slavery. We owe it to our people and to ourselves to make sure that doesn't sink through the ground. Right now, we've just left folks to die.
So, Khalil, that's our responsibility to each other. Let me go now to how we hold the system accountable. And I want to go back to 1994, because here we are now in the midst of a presidential campaign with one Hillary Clinton, who many people see as the presumptive nominee for the Democratic nomination. Bernie Sanders doesn't quite see it that way. We'll see how that plays out.
Yes.
But in this campaign, her husband now, former President Bill Clinton, as we know, days ago went on the campaign trail officially, campaigning for his wife. You know where I'm going with this, right?
Yes.
1994, Bill Clinton as president passes the crime bill, which is what caused a lot of this mess that you just saw in this video. He has since apologized. I recall, last year went to the NAACP, Urban League, one of those conventions, and apologized publicly.
Right.
For the role that he played in advancing the cause of this nonsense. So politically, what do you make of the mess that we're in now? Where do you see us headed?
Well, I think the Clintons bear a lot of responsibility. Hillary has also apologized on behalf of her husband and the politics of the nation at that time. I also think that we can't let Joe Biden off the hook for being a staunch advocate of tougher and aggressive policing. The bottom line, though, is that we need much more than just a fundamental reversal of the politics of crime and punishment, the tough on crime, the law and order ethos that gave us the greatest incarceration population the world has ever seen. We also need a fundamental linking of the criminal justice system with our economy. And that's the part of the conversation that I'm not hearing in the bipartisan reform movement. That's the part of the conversation that Clinton herself is separating out. Those two things need to be linked together, because the bottom line is, as a historical fact, we couldn't have had mass incarceration if it wasn't for deindustrialization, if it wasn't for policies like NAFTA, which the Bill Clinton himself was also responsible for, and also the fact that we turned to the personal responsibility and
Welfare Act of 1996, 2 years after the crime bill, is another slamming in the face of the responsibility of this nation to address fundamental inequality, which black people have borne much more disproportionately. So it's a even worse situation in terms of what the reversals need to be politically and as a matter of public policy than even the crime bill of 1994.
I didn't know we were going to go there. Let me follow you here, though, because I think it makes perfect sense, and I'm glad you raised this. So if Bill Clinton is in part responsible by supporting and passing the crime bill and then coming behind it, what he called the welfare reform bill that many of us at the time called the welfare deform bill, because we thought then it might pull away the safety net, social safety. As you recall, Mary Rod Edelman, Children's Defense Fund, her husband, Peter Edelman, sure, who was in the Clinton administration, publicly resigned and split with Bill Clinton over this welfare reform issue. So let's put those two things at Clinton's feet, crime bill, welfare bill. So I hear your point about the policies and how we reverse that, but how we make this link. So if, in fact, Hillary Clinton is going to be the Democratic nominee, we'll see how that plays out later this year, but that's going to happen. What are you suggesting? I want to be explicit about this. What are you suggesting now that black people need to demand of her now? Because I see black folks starting to line up, as we typically do, behind whoever the Democratic nominee is going to be.
Well, they have to make sure that they hold her accountable to actionable responses. So Bernie Sanders is an economic populist. Mm-hmm. He's made it very clear that he's prepared to hold the bankers of this nation accountable for their practices, to hold our corporate governance structures responsible for the CEO compensation. Mm-hmm. In other words, black people need to take Bernie Sanders seriously in order to be able to hold Hillary Clinton seriously. Mm-hmm. No one can, at the end of the day, make a politician do what they said they're going to do on the campaign trail. And we've certainly seen that in time immemorial. But it is absolutely essential that we press Hillary Clinton in terms of Bernie Sanders being the lever for extending the conversation to linking what does a social safety net look like in the 21st century, in an era of globalization, in an era where there are billions of people around the world who have no reasonable pathway to work. And here in this country, black people are the ones who, as Lonnie Guinier once said, are the miners' canaries.
So, Connie, when we did this original book 10 years ago, it wasn't about Barack Obama then. This new updated book 10 years later is not about Obama now. His name is barely mentioned. It was then, it is now, about the state of our own community. Having said that, you cannot divorce the state of black America over the last 10 years from the policies of the Obama administration for 7 or 8 of those years. So here's my question. Eric Holder left office being given some high marks by many in the black civil rights community for the moves he made on justice issues like drug offenses and, you know, et cetera, voting rights for former felons and stuff. How do you regard what the Obama administration has or has not done on justice issues, specifically where black folk are concerned?
If I had to give it a grade, it'd be a B minus.
A B minus. As in boy.
As in boy.
Okay.
You know, this president did not focus on these issues at all for the first term. I think that Holder felt a little bit of freedom in his second round, just as the president feels a little bit more freedom to acknowledge anything African-American in his second term. But this has not been a presidency about justice for black people. That has not been a priority. It hasn't been a focus. And so I can't really say that there was ever any kind of effort. I think that there have been things that have inadvertently advantaged or helped the African American community. There have been a few things that were more directly affecting, like the drug, the sentencing reforms and the drug policy reforms. And yes, those things absolutely. But if you were to look at a justice program for African Americans, it wouldn't look like what the Obama administration has done. It just wouldn't.
Two things I want to get back to, Khalil. But it's important, I think, and a prime question for you, given what you do for a living. I asked a question of one of our guests. I asked how they sensed that historians into the future are going to regard this moment. That is to say, on the one hand, you had the arrival, the ascension of the first black president in the history of the nation. At the same time, on that watch, the bottom fell out for Black America in so many ways.
Sure.
Black Lives Matter had to come into existence because Black men and Black boys and Black women, for that matter, being shot and killed in the streets. And so they can't find a way, to your point, Connie, to arrest banksters on Wall Street, but Black kids protesting in the street get locked up for protesting, et cetera, et cetera, right, et cetera. How do you, you're a historian, so how do you think historians take a stab at this? They're going, how are they going to juxtapose these two realities? You got a Black man in the White House.
Right.
But in so many ways, the bottom over that decade fell out.
Sure. Well, I think that they're going to see these last couple of years as a restoration of his overall legacy, mm-hmm, because they're going to want to root for him. Mm-hmm. They're going to want to see both the symbolism of his arrival in the White House in 2008 as a real transformative moment for American politics and for our racial journey writ large. They're also going to see the Republican response to his presidency as a form of racist bigotry unleashed in the country that we haven't seen really since the late 19th century, mm-hmm, in the midst of a then populist uprising that really purged a lot of the interracial alliances of the labor movement back in that moment. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of contextual details that those historians are going to bring to bear on this presidency. But many of them are going to also look closely at the wiring that made up the logic of his Black agenda, or the lack thereof. And they're going to see ultimately that the president himself was far more right of center on understanding the nature of Black poverty, the nature of our criminal justice system for the first 6 years of his presidency. And they're going to really replay a script that says something like this: because Black men aren't in the home and because Black children aren't studying hard enough, they are the cause of their own poverty, and that poverty is a tangle that leads to prison. Which is ultimately say that they're going to see that a structural critique was not a robust part of the Obama presidency for the first 6 years. And that's inescapable. But they will be sympathetic to it, and they will see these last couple of years as a bit of a reversal, mm-hmm, on those early ideas and the way that they were enacted in his presidency.
Our mutual friend, I guess, Michael Eric Dyson, professor at Georgetown, has a new book coming out in, yep, February. Just landed on my desk. I haven't had a chance to read the whole thing yet, but the book is called The Black Presidency. And on the race question, my read, I may be oversimplifying this, Professor Dyson, forgive me, but I think I got this basically right from what I've read so far. Dyson's basic argument is, if I can put it in a sentence, is that the president didn't do enough on the race question, but that he couldn't do anything because of the obstructionism that,
right,
you just mentioned.
Right, right.
Is that going to sell, Connie, that he didn't do nothing on race, didn't do anywhere near what he should have done, but the brother really couldn't do nothing? You buy that argument?
You know, I can entertain that argument.
That's an interesting word, entertain.
I can entertain that.
But is it entertaining? Yeah.
I don't know that I'd be convinced.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. It was very clear to me, and make no mistake, the election of Obama is transformative just by its own existence.
Sure, sure, sure.
It is going to be one of those pivotal moments, and I have to say personally, you know, that it was an incredible feeling. I love, mm-hmm, the man, even though I could hit him upside his head for several things, from deportation.
And Secret Service would, please don't do that. Call Secret Service. Khalil and I have to bail you out, and I don't know if we have that much money, but go ahead.
Yeah. I could never discuss with the president his deportations.
Yeah,
I could,
sure,
never discuss. I mean, there's so many things that I really violently disagree with him on, but I can't, you know, you just can't, mm-hmm, gloss over the enormity of his election, number one. Number two, I don't think the Professor Dyson is wrong. If he wanted a second term, there was no way he was going to be able to focus on race. I think he had a little more leeway than he thought he did, mm-hmm, but not much.
Mm-hmm.
Not much. Because the rabidity and the tenaciousness and the viciousness, mm-hmm, of the opposition,
yeah,
just unprecedented, and there wasn't going to be very much room. I'm sure he felt much more constrained by that, mm-hmm, than anything else.
So here's the exit question, I think, Khalil, for you, and please chime in when you, whatever you want to say a second ago. So how do Black people take, I don't know, phrase this the right way, if we didn't hold Obama accountable because we were too deferential for any number of reasons that we could have discussed, we didn't have time to get into it, but,
sure,
essentially we were too deferential, Black people, to the president. I get all that on some level. But how do you now show up for the next president, no matter who it might be, who she might be, and start making demands on their watch when you didn't hold the brother accountable? How do you do that? Just tell me how we're going to do that.
It's going to be an exercise in dissonance. I mean, because I have made this point many times, and particularly at the Schomburg Center in Harlem, where you've got an amazing black public sphere, and black folks have been incredibly supportive of the president's. We've had a couple of watch parties during the elections. It is going to be a very interesting thing to watch. What I will say is this. I think that the president has launched us into a new era. We know we're not in a post-civil rights era because we've got a new social justice movement. We know we're not in a post-racial era because we've got Donald Trump as a candidate in 2016. what we may be in is a post-assimilation society. Uh-huh. And what do I mean by that? President Obama ascended to the highest office in the land. As a single individual, had the most power to express ideas and opinions, to rewrite our history in his language and rhetoric, to push an agenda even against the obstructionism. In many ways, he did not express that power as greatly as he could have. The lesson that black people have to take away from that at this moment is this is not about black firsts any longer. Mm. This is not about getting into an office. There is no magic office or magic platform that will solve black people's problems. It is about the politics and the ideas behind those politics. It is about organizing. It is about having values and a vision that will fundamentally redress the historical mistreatment and inequalities that still shape this nation today.
Dr. Muhammad, thank you for your insights. Thank you for your work at the Schomburg for these years. You've been there, and all the best to you at Harvard.
Thank you.
And Connie Rice, always good to have you on, and continued success with you with the Advancement Project.
Okay.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.